things we need to do, if we focus a little bit on some of the field testing stuff and just the, I think there are dynamics around field testing. I'm not sure how far we'll get with that. Second thing was communication side in terms of what the reporting side of it. And there's some very simple practical things in that. I was talking at one of the breaks with Natasha, who's doing the effects analysis for revenue recognition. And the very simple things like, if you have any basis for conclusions, which is our second report, if you put the effects at the end in one section, it looks like it's an afterthought. Mm-hmm. If you spread it throughout the document, it's lost. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to get some feedback on that. And again, my suggestion is, you'll see when we get there, that we spread it throughout it generally, but then have a separate summary report that goes out with the final standard. Or we do something like the releases. So these are the dilemmas we're facing, and we'd like your feedback on that as well. So if I can just go on, I think I've got enough to feedback in terms of talking about clarity of expectations, and then there's some strong principles here: proportionality, very clear objectives, and then you're picking some sort of test or collecting evidence that helps support that particular objective. And I think what I'm intend to do is I want to give quite a few examples in the report of things that we have been doing in the past that and perhaps some of the work also that EFRAG has been doing and the FASB, so that we can feed through in terms of surveys. I think they're quite helpful, and we can identify some of the characteristics of surveys. So I think it tends to be, as Tommaso said, potentially a little bit shallower, but much broader, as opposed to some of the field work that we do the what-if analysis. It can be deeper, but it's a much narrower sample set, and therefore not as generalizable, for example. So each of these things, these types of evidence, have good features or some good redeeming features and some limitations. And I think the idea for this is to document what, give it a slight steer to say, you know, if you're doing something like the impairment testing, then the type of thing that you could do to support that, but identify the limitations and identify the strengths. Because one of the things we cannot do is to say every effects analysis will have the following four tests in here, because proportionality and specificity are so critical to this whole thing. So does that kind of make sense in terms of that section? So you know, if we start to get the report out to you and get back, I'll see if others can, you know, and if it's possible, Claudia's, once she's recovered from her, what do you call it, her pregnancy, I suppose, it's, once she's back at work, or somebody else, if there are some good examples, because I know we've had some very good engagement with the European Commission before, and been given a couple of examples of how case studies can be presented and things like that. So it would be helpful to get some non-accounting things that people know are very helpful, because that can help us think more generally about what good tests are.
But you want examples about the process? Because impact analysis are all public in the website, so it's not a problem. But if you want just explanation about how it is.
Public examples of sorts of little tests or field testing that has found its way into good effects analysis that you think is actually a good way of conveying or testing a particular type of thing.
But what I didn't mention just earlier, and as you can see, Claudio has experience in evaluation, because there's a unit in charge of that, and so we have different competencies. And obviously, doing an effects analysis is not like developing accounting standards. It's two different things, and that's why we have a unit gathering all knowledge on evaluation and impact assessment, and then helping operational units, and that's different competencies.
That's
right. Okay.
Is this unit separated from the others, or?
Yeah, it's a clearly identified unit, so which is there to support all kind of impact analysis, impact assessment done in the DG internal market, and then at the level of the Commission. So they are very specialized and have very and they can and they can guide technical persons to build on that. So again, it's a bit of a different structure than the IASB, where you say that you don't have the competencies or you cannot go further on certain issues, but then it's a different job.
So just to push that, and I might be reading too much into your question, Tomaso, but in a sense it would be like us getting a couple of economists onto our staff to help us in that work. And so I think if I'm right, so it's not that this unit actually prepares all the effect analysis. They go and support the people who've done the work and help them with that expertise. So
guidance. Then the operational unit does what they are supposed to do on their technical field, and then there is an impact assessment board with completely independent people in the commission, but independent from the project, gives them advice.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't want to create monsters in these things, but I wonder whether... and look at David in this. One thing to think about. No, it's whether or not it wouldn't hurt for us to have a consultative group that we could draw now and again to help. But I think if the things we're embedding this in our processes anyway, I'm not sure how much we do. But I can imagine this at the end of a process, these experts helping put together that summary report. Possibly, I'm not sure. I'll have to think about whether, but certainly getting competencies in place here to help us. It's something as simple as saying, I'm going to put together a survey. There are lots of people who are very good at putting surveys together and making sure that you understand what inference is about, sample selection and what sample selection biases and all those sorts of things. And actually have a write a survey deliberately putting in questions that might create that you know when you look at the two answers together, they're supposed to complement each other, and so you're looking for things. So getting some expertise in to help us with those things might. We've always been looking at that and within that one of our support teams anyway.
I think a key issue with that kind of work is consistency between the projects, that if you have variation in these effect analysis between projects, that there's actually a reason for it other than having different staff on it. I think there is a skill set issue that Chris Bell mentioned. I think something like drafting a good questionnaire is actually surprisingly hard. It's quite easy to end up with loads of leading questions, etc. So I think there is a bit of support necessary, perhaps. And I think what is important is that people don't end up field testing their own work for credibility reasons, not because they don't make a diligent effort. But if I the Peter Decker ED, you're going to say, well, he said it's a good ED, but then again, he wouldn't be. There's a credibility point there. And there are various ways in which you can address that, whether you want to do that with your board or something. But I think you need to have something in there that acts as the check and balance in the mechanism.
Now, I think this I've drawn this out anyway, in terms of we've got the issues about sample selection and so on, but having participation with other standard settings. I think when Philippe's made and Tomaso and Peter and others, you can work with other standard setters. It seems to me that, and that helps broaden the base, in other words, you get much broader samples or number of participants in field tests in particular. It seems to me, unless I'm overstating this, that it's easier for us to receive information from other standard setters than it is for us to provide information to those standard setters. Because it seems that when we conduct this, there's a confidentiality issues, then in a sense, people seem to be more willing, likely or not, to share with us, but not with others. And so we have some constraints in what we can do. But we certainly are happy to receive even if it's summary information, I think. And I think it's a bit like, you know, I talked to as I was saying before, to Peter about if we identify a relative homogeneity within Europe, or Europe is different to other countries, you want to know about that. And similarly, if you've got some summary information that seems to conflict with our information, then we should investigate it. And it is a case, it's, again, it's about corroboration of evidence and getting a broader base. So I was going to suggest that we put something in here and talk about that, that as being important. Because at a very practical level, it is kind of like saying, I've got a local issue here that affects just me in one country, whether it's in Asia or it's to do with Sharia law, for example, where there's an effect that you might not have anticipated, that's being brought to our attention. You know, so I think that's that, and that that's something we need to build into this communication side with the National Standards Service. Others encourage them to do this work, not by themselves, because we'd kind of like them to find out what sort of instruments we've got and try and perhaps duplicate that and do the sort of groundwork themselves and then feed that back to us. In some ways, I think this is the less controversial than this morning was. Maybe not. Okay.
Listen, I do believe that if you can reach the help of the standard set in the neighboring jurisdictions, will be a lot of help for the ISB when they are doing the new standards or revising the standards, okay? If we can link them to our work, to our goal, it will be much better, because they are the ones that have, that can hold the more reliable information about economic impacts and the realities of their own jurisdictions. So I would believe that if we have a paper once and standardized that can reach a range of reliable information, it will allow us to have representative realities and a first-hand information and support for a new or revised standard. We can also reach government support by the fact that if applying IFRS, it means transparency. If the service should be done for economic activities, okay? So maybe doing range of economic activities, so especially where effects are more likely to appear. So that's my point of view. I'm totally agree that we have to reach this connection, this linking with the standard setters in every jurisdiction. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, that's helpful. It's we have quite a good relationship with most standard setters, but it's probably an area we haven't done much in terms of field testing with them, other than through Europe, a little bit with FASB on our joint projects. But other than that, I guess when we've done the outreach and gone to different countries, it's been not so much field testing per se. And in fact, I don't know the answer to this. I don't know whether we did, in fact, use the AASB, for example, to help us with the Australian or not, so or whether we asked them to go and do further testing. It's a good point. So any other, within the room, any other issues about sort of field testing? Because I've got one, it relates a little bit to communication, but I think it's more, it's probably the methodology. I was going to suggest that one way of conveying this would be to identify, and it's because this keeps coming up, identify not whereabouts in the process you're more likely or you expect to see us to do some particular work. For example, with us, the process is we do some research, we get to a discussion paper, then an ED, then an IFRS, then a post-implementation review. And in terms of, I would have thought, the discussion paper, you know, we spoke earlier about leases, about the error rate between the rule of thumb times 8 and what we might see if we put discounted cash flows on there. You could argue that probably needs to be done at the DP phase, because discussion paper phase, because that's actually the heart of the problem that we're trying to fix. And so I was thinking of trying to relate some of the testing, the field testing, the field work, and the types of information you're looking for to the various phases. And I think it's to your point, Crystal, you said, well, we should be doing some type of assessment. And I'm thinking, now, when do we do that? At the end or at the beginning? And I think if we indicate roughly in the process where we expect that to happen, then that gives us a sense or helps us embed that more throughout the system. Sue?
Yeah, that's a clarifying question. When you talk about a discussion paper in this early stage, you have two kinds. One is an invitation to comment. Then another is preliminary views where you're heading down the, here's a solution. Which kind of those do you expect to be issuing at the discussion paper stage, or at this pre-standard setting agenda phase? Some words you use make me believe it's more of an invitation to comment. Other things suggest it's more of a preliminary view.
That's a good question because we actually, it's a new process for us. We actually haven't had produced our first one yet with this. I see this more intent. I don't know whether I want to call it preliminary views or an invitation to comment. It would be a research or discussion paper for which we would go out in public comment. The recommendations are likely to be either A, in the paper we would identify what the financial reporting problem is that we're trying to fix, and to go to ourselves, issue the baseline, do nothing or do something, and explain why we either A, are recommending that we do nothing and we simply stop this project today, or a recommendation that we do something and then what the board's, and that could be what the board's preferences or what the board thinks the better answer is, in quite general terms. So, and then we would get comments on that, and then the board would make a decision, yes, we're going to start a standards level project on this. That's the idea. I'm not sure how I'd characterise that, preliminary views or...
Well, the reason why I asked was, I think when the boards go down the path of picking a solution, when you start to get effects analysis creeping in.
Yeah.
So how did you decide to pick that one? So in terms of the timing of the work and what work you do when, to me it is some way function of what decision the board is making when. And without having an understanding of what kind of decision the board is making at this discussion paper stage, it's hard for me to evaluate how much work you must do.
Or it could be, you might go out and say, well, do nothing or do something. And do something could be, to Patrick's earlier view, it could be two alternative ways of doing it.
Right, without choosing
one. And then you'd have to, start to build in, we think, at this initial stage, the likely effect of option A would be this. The likely effect at this stage, as far as we can tell, of option B would be that. And then throwing that out to get comments back from constituents that then might lead the board to say, well, if we're going to do something, B looks...
Yeah.
So the purpose is to solicit information about it.
Well, it's both, yeah. So one is set out an initial thought to say, you know, from the basis of what we've got so far, we think the effects will be this. Do you agree, do you disagree, or have we missed something?
But what I might expect to see is some evidence of the scale of a particular problem, or the extent of a problem. If somebody comes to us and says, you need to account for this thing, we have no inconsistency, we then go and find out there's only ever been one example of that transaction ever, then we simply say, well, actually, no, we don't need to. Whereas if something's pervasive, that, well, actually, pervasive might be just as bad, but then there's too much to bite off. But there's getting evidence to show that there is a problem here. We've got, you know, five different ways that the same transaction's being presented around the world, so we need to address it. So I would always expect to see that in the discussion paper phase. Okay, it's not something we expect to see in the wrap-up phase at the end. You know, you shouldn't even start the thing unless you understand the scale. Daniel?
I think it's easier to look at the different phases to say what's the objective of the effects analysis in each phase, not really what you're going to do.
Yeah. That's helpful because the objective of the discussion paper is to decide whether or not there is a problem in financial reporting and whether it's likely that you are going to get a cost-beneficial solution to it, whether you can get improvements cost-beneficial ways. So that's am I going to do more work, for example? Peter?
I think in the different phases of a project, you have different questions to answer. So I think if you're very early on in the process, research phase, you may well want to do descriptive statistics to say, well, how big is this thing? So if you were going to run a project on, say, the equity method, you might want to find out what's the carrying amount, is it very concentrated, where does it live, and what is it used for?
Thank you. On the phones?
The question that is, from my understanding, in the report you distinguish field work and what if analysis. I wonder what the difference is. I understand that in one case you will work on case studies and on the second case on real situation with participants, or are there more differences?
No, so what if analysis is a subset of field work. I'm just looking at my head in to make sure they're okay. Field work can be a variety of things, including what if analysis. But the one thing that is I did was analysis and other evidence empirical assessment. I know you'd have to dig through back to get the papers. And the way field work is going and talking to people and getting them to read the standard and apply it, work with them. On the other hand, the work we're doing on leases, where we're actually going and analysing financial statement data ourselves, I wouldn't consider that a what if analysis in a sense. You could argue it's a form of it. I'm trying to differentiate in a sense of going and talking to people who are going to use the standard, either the preparers or the users, as opposed to us doing some analysis involving collecting data or looking, even of course, things that the academics might do with price earnings relationships or something like that. So in the case of leases, I think, is one, because we're interrogating the data. The other one was non-controlling interest acquisition, where in the business combinations project, we people said non-controlling interest or minority interest is going to be devastated. We discovered that only about 8 companies in the top 600 in Europe actually had big lots of minority interest. And so we actually found some data there, as opposed to going and talking to people about it. And I think they're just different types of analysis. We've got to be very careful we don't create little labels around these things. We're just looking for evidence in different ways. So if it looks like you're getting little labels that are a bit rigid, push back and tell us to change them.
But then we have to describe it somehow, and it means to me like, what if it's modelling? Is that what it is? Modelling.
What if it's modelling? The thing is, we can model and you can model. And so I could sit there and I could sort of, it's one of our criticisms we got on IFRS 10 consolidations. We sat there with cases that we were given and we worked out what we thought the effect would be, as opposed to going along and saying, if you read these words, you tell us what you think the effect would be of the change in standards. So they're just the what-ifs you can do in 2 different ways. Our assessment or somebody else's assessment. And if it's somebody else's, you're usually testing 2 things. One is how they read the words, plus how it works with the data. Whereas if we're doing it our way, we've written the words, so we know what we think we mean anyway. And they give you different levels of confidence.
But you do that into stages, presumably, so you don't let them interpret that wrongly and grant models some wrong understanding.
Yeah. That's one of the difficulties with field testing, because you actually, trying to take the impairment side of it. If you've got differences in the likely effect of that in terms of their portfolio, that could be reading the words differently. It was because they got different economic circumstances. And trying to differentiate between those two is very important. If it's poor wording, it's quite a different beast. So that's why I think there were the 2-hour briefings up front for this is what we mean. There are different tests.
I do think that we could actually benefit from a bit of common vocabulary, because I've sat in quite a few meetings where we end up furiously agreeing, but it takes us quite a while to realise that that's actually the case.
Yeah, I think part of this report should be a glossary of terms as well, so we understand, because Sue's sent me a couple of notes now and again saying, can you please tell me what these things mean in your environment? And when we ever talk to the FASB, for example, I think field test maybe we mentioned it last time, had very specific connotations. They were people setting up parallel systems often and running that for a year or something like that in conjunction with their existing system, and you were testing the differences. So that's why we use the word term field work in our due process handbook to give a wider meaning, saying it's anything where you're going out into the field and working with people. So I'll make sure there's a glossary there too. So a clear message I've got is, yes, perhaps do a timeline or a cycle where you've got DPED, IFRS and post-implementation review, but don't focus so much on what types of testing you do, focus more on what the objective of an effect analysis or the objective is of each of the phases, and then the actual tests or the tasks you do with that should just drop out naturally from that as well.
You know, on the various tests and approaches that we described here, I think it would be helpful to have a bit of information for your staff to sort of help them select the right approaches. So it's like now it's sort of like, oh, we have a whole lot of stuff, good luck. And I think having a little bit of a guide as to you may want to consider the following approaches for the following situations. I wouldn't over-engineer it, but do a little bit of that thinking and selecting for them might be helpful.
Communication. It's a bit quicker than I thought. So. So it's on page 32 of the report. Yes, just a couple of things to. In terms of context, and we've had covered this a little bit already, I think one of the criticisms we have faced historically is that we've produced a summary effects analysis at the end, and it looks like it's an afterthought. And so it's very important that people see that the ISB is bought into this. And as I said, we've changed our due process. It's all been endorsed by the trustees from now on. And so we don't want to look at projects that haven't followed the new process and dwell too much on those. The idea is supposed to be from now on that as we develop a project, we're considering these effects as we go, and it's clearly important that we need to put those into the basis of conclusions to demonstrate two things, that in fact what difference are them, and secondly it signs off, because that's another criticism we've had for our summary reports, is that particularly with the effect analysis in three reports so far, our board didn't actually vote on those as part of the balloting. If it's in the basis for conclusions, it's part of our formal balloting or voting processes.
And that's on the wording of the recommendation is some paragraph 100. In the exposure draft, I would say that should include the analysis of the likely effects and the explanation of how these effects were considered by the ISB.
Yeah, I think we've moved on a bit too from the information this morning about the two things about the quality and so on, plus the awareness and so on. So this whole recommendation needs to change quite a bit now, I think, because it's... we've got a much richer sort of understanding, I think, of what we're communicating.
I think the other thing you need to keep in mind is your staff does quite a bit of work as the project goes along, so there's quite a bit of analysis here and there in agenda papers. That's not very easy to retrieve. So if you say it's sort of an ongoing flow, that's a question whether sort of the tombstone effect analysis that appears 3 months after this standard is really the tool, whether you need another means to give people access to that kind of information, even if it's only on the project page, references in the following papers we've considered.
Yeah, well,
type issues.
As we've been discussing today, we actually have a paper that we take at the we do it at each milestone, a review of due process. We have a series of things that we consider, and I'm wondering whether we need to adapt that a little bit to include a little bit more about the effects. And on our website now, within each project, we actually have a special thing for due process on there, so that every time that any due process papers are discussed, you can find them, because to your point, Peter, otherwise you'd actually have to remember that it was March 2006, paper 6B or something was the due process paper. Now we actually label them quite clearly and put them aside, and I wonder whether this is another area we need to think about a little bit. So when we do a wrap-up, what we ask the board to do with the due process side is to sit back and reflect. Okay, so are you comfortable that you've done these things and these things, got enough information and so on? Are you ready to wrap this set part of it up and go on to the next level? And if we do that with the effects side of it, that might just be it's your chance to reflect and move on to the next bits.
The other point I would make is that you may want to consider whether you have different audiences for these kind of reports.
Yeah.
One that gets it in landscape and all glossy, and one that probably gets the need.
We're not sure about the landscape and glossy, because I like to be business-like about our effects analysis to show how serious we are. So, but you're right, the audience is very important as well.
Absolutely, and that was my point, I think, Alan. This is partly about communication, but actually, crucially, it's about accountability. And I think it's important that this report draws out very clearly the fact that in making decisions, the effects analysis is taken into account, both in terms of what it says, the impact, and the substance of the analysis, but also in terms of the quality of the analysis, the fact that it's followed a proper process. So if IASB is making, or the Foundation is making a decision, then in making that decision, it is clear, publicly clear, A, that an analysis has been undertaken, and that the results have been reflected properly in the processes, and B, that analysis has been of a good quality. And lots of mechanisms. I mean, we all have mechanisms for addressing that. In fact, we've got Sue here. You know, you've got a peer review process, if you like. You've got people looking at this from inside and outside. But you had Chris here. But I think it would be good if the report draws that out. And I'd love to see the word accountability somewhere in it, perhaps in big bold letters.
Well, that's a cornerstone,
because it's actually the effects analysis section in the due process handbook is under the title of accountability. So,
there is.
In principle, it's absolutely.
Yeah. But let's bring it out.
Yeah.
You know, really explicitly.
But it's a classic example, isn't it? Haven't you read page 16 of the due process handbook?
No, I haven't. I can promise you. I haven't.
Yeah. It's about communication, yeah. And it's about making it easier, which is why we've got multiple audiences, and it's got to be very clear. And even this whole report, instead of just say to people, refer to due process handbook, you need to pull out of that the very important pieces and make them spell it out for people. So is anybody interested in a peak analysis, for example, is going to want to just go to one place and get the whole story.
So I think to follow up on your point, if you're saying it's more important for this group to make recommendations about what the objectives of the communication are, and the kinds of things that should be included in the report to achieve those objectives, and then leave the ISB some discretion about the best way to achieve it.
Yeah.
For some cases, it may be short and sweet and easy to put in the basis.
Yeah.
Major standards,
absolutely.
Maybe not, but needs to be publicly available. What is it and what's in it?
Okay, so am I hearing it right? You're saying, keep on putting the stuff throughout the basis, but we need a separate report. Okay, is that right? Possibly. Proportionality.
I was going to say a separate report to be clearer, but I'm the only one. I would not fight for it.
I agree with you. I think separate report is better.
Well, we do. We have a feedback statement now, which is, I think, aimed at sort of very executive level in a sense. That's a glossary. It's a communications document. But we do have different levels of reports that we do. So I don't think we're not fighting having a separate report.
Yeah.
We think it could be very helpful.
But the basis for conclusions goes with the standard, and the people who need to read the text analysis on the 10-page summary won't necessarily read the snapshot, or it's different audiences.
But they want to be reassured that the board itself has ownership of this, not just the staff.
If we do it just at the end, that the board are not signing off on any fees, which is the process. So, you know, if we pull it all out of the basis and just had a separate report, I think we'd be accused of not integrating our thinking. So it's a tricky balance.
But why can't you have both documents in front of the board, basis of conclusion, the standard, and the effect analysis?
That's what
but they don't have to be in one place.
I remember what the advice we gave last meeting.
And the reality is we have to acknowledge that in most of the cases we have so far, we have sat down there and pulled. It's not been new data, new analysis, but it's been pulled out 3 months or so after we finished the standard. It's kind of like, I didn't have time to get it done before, so I do it afterwards, and we're saying it's got to be done at the time.
I think the other thing to keep in mind is if you put it in the basis of conclusions in all of its glorious detail, it will go into your band volumes as well.
Yeah, and you'll get an example of the instruments we use for our field testing and the methodology, and that's not really basis of conclusions, it's evidence. It would be like taking out board papers.
It's more the summary in the basis for conclusions and then the
report. You put a filter over the basis of conclusions and pull out the stuff that is relating to the effects analysis and just summarise it. I was going to say you might change the language a bit, but I'm not sure why you would, because if it either changes the language to make it clearer and easier to understand, I don't know why the basis doesn't have the same.
I think in the basis for conclusion, I would like to see what how the ISB address these effects, how the effects were impacted the decisions, and then on a separate paper would see both the ISB decision on effects and the methodologies and more detailed information on what was the process followed for effect analysis.
And I think the problem, it's not the problem, because we're still learning. In the case of leases, we've put in an appendix, although I'm not sure for those grants actually should be part of the basis for conclusions. They might be set off, being separated out of it, so it's part of the summary of everything.
Yeah, probably have to be set objectives, basis and the other
thing. Thomas' idea is quite same as Fesley just putting some summary of it, like there is just a couple of pages, and the separate, another separate whole paper of effect analysis.
Yeah, we're lucky. We're evaluating what is the best thing to communicate and is looking at whether or not we have different audiences that have different needs. And if they do, we must meet those needs. You know, just one size fit all. And so we haven't concluded on how we're going to communicate.
I'm going to go back to the phones in a second too, but I'll push up. I was going to ask you who the audience is of this summary document anyway, but I'll suggest something. When we went along to our Global Preparers Forum, so the preparers, and our Capital Markets Advisory, CMAC, Advisory Committee, so it's the users, analysts, we actually took the effect analysis stuff in there to them as well, and we said, so, if you were sitting there reading what the new requirements are, you got the new standards out, and we gave you this document, what would you want to see in there that convinced you that this was a good idea? You know, in terms of, not the 200-page basis of conclusions, but what would give you comfort that we actually made the right decisions for good reasons? And to me, that sounds like what an effect analysis is, because I suspect I think anyway, most regulators who use this, and I think we said it much earlier today, that it's almost like it's not ancillary, but it's a byproduct of what the board's doing, that regulators can pick it up and use it. And so I'm not sure that I don't think we're writing this to regulators. We're as much writing this to preparers and investors as anybody else to explain and convince them why it's such a good idea that we've changed the accounting. Whereas the basis is more, it tells the story section by section, as you mentioned in here. The basis normally follows the structure of the standard. And the most important thing might actually be, you know, three quarters of the way down, whereas an effect analysis is probably flipped around the other way. It's an order of its most important issues first. Then it's like the rationale. Why did we do this in the first place? And then where are the biggest changes likely to be affected and so on? So does that sound right? It's a general audience?
Yeah, it does sound right. And as an accountant, I use the conclusion quite a lot just interpreting the standard. And it's quite nice if it follows the order of the chapters. While I think effect analysis is used differently at different times, perhaps.
I agree, because one of the things, the basic conclusion today is twofold in that. First of all, it gives a rationale why it shows this solution, but it's also explaining the content of the standard in some way. So it's both. So that's also, I agree with you, but it's good thing to keep it that way, but the effect analysis and pull it out. Because that is about the decision making and communication to external.
But the effects analysis should inform the decision.
That's right.
I agree.
Paul's just been called away, so I'm just sending a quick message. He's hoping to join soon, but I'm not sure how much longer we need to be here either. So it's not, we're in raging agreement at the moment. It worries me. Well, nothing really. But I think we're getting a good sense of what this should be about in terms of this separate document. I'll ask you a question, though, about at the phases, because I've suggested it in the within the report that we'd only do the separate summary report at the last bit. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't get the effects being conveyed, because they would be built into the basis. Because we've debated internally about what do we do? And on the one hand, it takes a lot of effort to get a separate report. And I guess we'd always considered that, you know, I'd always had in mind this is for regulators more than anybody else, but I'm now less convinced it is. I think it's a more general audience. Should we be doing this at the ED phase and the final phase, or should we just build it into our normal documents? Is it a separate part of it? What is it? In a way, it's a bit like, you know, we do have snapshots from ED and feedback statement for a snapshot and feedback statement for the final round.
I think you need to be practical. On the long run, I think it should be a separate document. You say it might be more difficult to prepare the document, but if you prepare the document over time, your end results would be better. So in the long run, I think it would be better to have a separate document from the start, but the interim, you can use other methods.
When I saw the wording of paragraph 98, is it this one where you say the summary report should only be necessary at the final standard stage?
Yeah, that's just doing a separate report.
Yeah.
So the discussion paper phase might be embedded in the text.
Yeah,
so you
clearly
separate
the
letters.
Discussion paper already?
Yeah.
Because the theory gives the impression that, yeah, you're going to have a full analysis in the end, and again, it's back to the discussion we had this morning on the timing. Decision makers and stakeholders need to have this information well ahead at this later stage. So it depends what you want to do with this report, perhaps not a full report, but at least what you consider is really useful at discussion.
Yeah, well, take an ED example. You know, that's another 40-something pages for leases. It's an appendix, or actually it's a section, then an appendix. were our basis for conclusions. So we didn't do a separate report called effects analysis or something like that, or likely effects. And we don't know whether that's the right thing. In a way, in some ways, I think the team felt a bit constrained because they did a lot more than this, to be honest, but then they only put the summary stuff in here. Because otherwise you end up with an effect analysis that's bigger than the rest of the basis. So
I would tend to think that the most important thing is the discussion paper when you have to weight the scenario. And so that's a bit my fear that we move the full final report.
No, I would imagine that I can foresee a discussion paper that it outlines what the problem is, etc., and then the back of it. An appendix that gives you all this empirical support for the scale of the problem, why is the problem, all that evidence and things like that, I think would be as part of the discussion paper. I think it's really important at that phase.
Well, again, I can't repeat myself, but I think it's more helpful to just describe and for us to, I guess, recommend what it is you want to communicate in each stage. I think this issue of separate report or what to me is just not all that important. What's important, and if you were to start at the end, yep, this is what we would be communicating when the final is standard, when the standard is final. Then do you want to be communicating the same thing at a DD stage? Do you want to be communicating the same thing or a different thing at the discussion paper stage? And it may be different because the depth of the analysis is different and the depth of the information is different. So you can, as the project develops, the depth of the effects analysis develops. It becomes wider and deeper. So, and that's what I'm not seeing in this paper. I'm seeing it's going to be a report and it's separate, and it doesn't really talk about what the content is, and yet today we spent a good bit of time talking about what we would expect to see. So I would hope the report would have some recommendations on it. You know, what we think the contents of the good effects analysis would be and how that unfolds over the life of the project.
I think the overwhelming message I'm hearing is you need to be able to see in some sort of cohesive way what the effects are. And I think people want to see a summary of that. In a way, you don't care whether it's in the basis as a separate section and whether it's a separate report or whatever it is. You want to sit there, and I think it's getting a story about why did we start this project? What was the problem we're trying to fix? What evidence did we have to show it was actually a problem? What did we consider? You know, we could have just done nothing. This is your, you know, baseline. Or we actually looked at five different things. We dismissed these because of these reasons. So we got down to two. And they're the ones we put out in the discussion paper. And from that, all the feedback we got, people told us that this was a better model to follow and so on, and then this is how we assessed it, this is what, and then, you know, reporting back all the summary stuff of what we just said we should be testing for. So it's how do you tell a story? And so the basis is too long in a sense, because it serves a slightly different purpose. This is trying to get a reasonable summary, and those people should be, they have to say it should be as long as it needs to be. I think we're talking, you know, I keep hearing sort of 30 to 40 page type thing. Gives you a real sense, and this is for a full standard, a proper standard, gives you a better sense of, you can tell the story about that sort of thing. We're not talking about a 200 page tome, and we're not talking about a 5 page glossy. It has to be a complete story of the journey from the beginning to the end.
Seems to me what Chris is emphasized on the DD stage is maybe she's thinking effect analysis on the all alternatives.
Yeah.
They might be quite important to get a good big direction. So after it's for the draft, you know, it may not be important to do effect. That's what you're concerned, right?
My idea was to give this information in the discussion paper on which you based your idea, to give also the stakeholders the opportunity to fit in and perhaps change the scenario you're selecting.
Yeah.
Because if you do that later at exposure draft like this, it's a bit late for stakeholders to react or to fit in or to
I think the other key thing about including an effective analysis in an exposure draft or discussion paper is, and we've done that in insurance and leases and impairment, so you can actually ask questions about it. Is this a sensible analysis or have we completely missed it? So you can actually get feedback during the process. And that's not free feedback, because if people say that analysis is fine, they're sort of committed to getting the owner as well.
So I'm not worried at all that we're going to make you unhappy when we write this up, because we will be, a lot of what you're talking about will be in the DP phase, I think, but we need to make it quite clear what the objective of a discussion paper is, and it comes down to Sue's question, you know, let's define these things. It's all very well to say we're going to produce a discussion paper, but a discussion paper will have an objective. And we should outline quite clearly what that objective is and what sort of information we expect to see in that. So I think, I'm hoping that when you see those words, you'll be happy as opposed to worried that we're waiting to the last minute.
I wonder, too, whether the detailed basis for, and this is a little bit where we went, the detailed basis for conclusion, just talking about all the alternatives the board considered.
Yeah.
And the summary effects analysis is compared to existing gaps. Because at least in our jurisdiction, that's the test, is it cost and benefits of the change relative to existing gaps. Not the journey you took to get there, but having landed where you landed, so the benefits justified.
Yeah, except I've heard several times people say they want to know if you had two choices, why did you pick that one and not that one?
And that's the basis, I think.
Well, I think I'm going to see that in an effects analysis. I'm hearing you want to. That's part of the effects, because particularly the jurisdictions and going through endorsement processes are looking at those trade-offs. And Paul mentioned it when he was on about that type of thing as well, where you need to know why you made those choices. So I agree that's in the basis, I'm not confusing myself now, but it's in the basics.
I think you have to have something in basis to explain why you reached the decision. And I think so there may be a little bit of duplication, because it's very hard to explain why you have reached that decision without talking a little bit about what other options are available. But the actual analysis, I think I would take separately. Sorry, I know I agree with you that it's not very important from the quality of the product, but I think from the perspective of the user of the financial, the book, I think I thought I had a smaller book. Something I can carry with me.
I don't know if this is a helpful analogy or something, but anybody who's used XML, imagine if you had the big basis of conclusions 300 pages long and you tagged all the paragraphs that related to effects and then just pulled those out into one document and then just knitted it together. Well, you might reorder it in terms of importance and knitted it together. I think we're trying to get a summary report that actually just extracts from the basis but then presents in a slightly different order. Because for our feedback status and our snapshots, we don't go through, the structure doesn't follow the standard. We like to think of ourselves as being pretty smart about anticipating where the problems are. We mostly get it right, because we know where the problems are, because people yell at us. So our feedback statements and our snapshots tend to say that these are the five big issues on the standard. So it's about ranking it a bit more. I kind of see that with the effect analysis as well. Well, in fact, if you've got these are the biggest issues, it's almost like taking our snapshot or feedback statement and then explaining the effects we considered at the same time, or what evidence and what choices we made. So it's embellishing it in a sense.
It becomes a summary basis of important.
Yeah.
When you describe it in that way. Which may not be a bad outcome, but.
No. Be a trickier part to write than I thought, but I think I've got an idea. Okay, I'm going to go back to the phones, because we've been haven't given you a chance, I'm going to go right through, and I'm not sure if you're really still there, but Alexei?
Yes, I am here.
Okay, I just wondering if we're at the point where we're a little bit close to wrapping up, because we've got almost through the most of the issues. I'm wondering if there are any final points you wanted to make.
Yes.
Okay. Karen, you still awake?
Yes, I'm still awake. No, look, I don't think I've got any final comments to make.
So I might, yeah, you and a couple of the others on the call, I might draw on you a little bit on the, we talk about academic research in there, so I might call on you to help out a little bit with the drafting that section.
Sure, no problem.
Okay. Lisa Ling, you still there?
Yes, I'm okay. I'm agreeing with that.
Okay.
Yes, I am here. I agree with the conclusion, and I just think that the report should be more simple.
Okay. Mataza?
Yeah, I think, Alan, just one thing, again, going back to the leases, you know, the effects on the income statement and balance sheet, which is basically described qualitatively, I think, if you can give some examples on in terms of the actual, you know, quantification in terms of, like, the actual cases with the numbers, I mean, that would be really great, you know. I mean, especially, like, you know, we have this different types of leases, like type A versus type B, so what are the actual accounting treatments? Like we have those four cases at the end of it, like the appendix, but those are like basically just talking about the cost that the entity might incur and the information that the entity needs. But if the examples are there, that would be really helpful.
Paul, are you back on the call? Nope. Doesn't sound like it. That just reminds me of one little point I forgot to mention with the leases as well. Is that we've been looking at the analysis and doing numbers running on with euros or pounds, etc. And we could do them down to the pennies or the cents or whatever. We actually think that's not that particularly helpful to do it. The best way to do it would be doing things like percentiles or deciles or something like that, where you say, look, the range of the error tends to be in these types of things, and giving more descriptive analysis rather than, because our worry is if you say, and from the companies we look at, I think they're about 700 or something like that, we've got about half a trillion euros of balance sheet leases, and we don't want to give the impression that if you stuck on the balance sheet, you'd get exactly that number on there. We can give a sense of scale, so we'll give some statistics about that, but in terms of, we don't want to say that this company would have had, you know, 50 million is off balance sheet, and if you multiply by 8, you get 50. But in fact, the right answer is 80, because that implies a level of accuracy that we're a bit concerned about, and also helps identify people when we're worried. So we think that one of the messages we need to get across to our staff more than anything else is that when they're reporting, I guess descriptive statistics and general quantitative feedback is better than implying real dollar values that you've got an effect on. So, but that's more for our staff, I think it is, than consultants. But it goes back a little bit to if you're doing cost analysis and implying an accurate number, when in fact what you're looking for are drivers of costs, such as complexity, system changes, and things like that. Just go around the room then, if there's anybody else got any concluding remarks or issues, things we've missed, what's next?
I have a question on, not what you've missed, but the paper talked a bit about coordinating with national standard setters.
Yep.
This is I wasn't clear on where you landed on how that would work. I think the final paper needs to be clear on that. And I know you talked about having MOUs between the ISB and the prudential regulators. I was wondering whether MOUs between the ISB and national standards setters to clarify roles and responsibilities. And who's going to do what? Which may vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Yes. It's a tricky issue because you will either end up with 50 MOUs or one charter. And that's the issue for us, is that we would kind of like to have more of a charter, I guess it is, in a sense of saying, this is, you know, with the ISB, we're supported by a network, it's national standard setters, are part of an important network, but these are the types of responsibilities we take on very seriously. These are things we would like our standard setters as part of the network to do as well. So, but you're right, I think it's clarifying that quite a lot, because if we are relying on input from a broader network, it's important that the other members of the network understand what we're relying on.
Well, and I think it's more than relying on. I think it's mechanisms for communicating with them. Who's doing what, when, and,
yep.
And you know, if the organization is operating in a jurisdiction, when they're out talking to people, it helps them to know when and how you're out talking to people.
Yep.
And whether you do that by charter or individual MOU is being as important as having good communication between them.
Yeah, we have a little bit of experience of working with other parties. And what does happen is there's a real decision to be made whether you want it to be a partnership where everybody has equal say, or whether you say, oh, I prefer a command and control structure, which may find you not signing up too many partners. So there's a real question. How do you organize the work? Who gets to say what? If you say everything must be unanimous, you'll never get anything off the ground. On the other hand, if you say to the various partners, why don't we all do an effect analysis on leases? People ask questions ABC. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and some must have Roman numerals up to 10. And you won't be able to aggregate that into a report and a conclusion. Not to mention that if you get 25 of those little different inputs, you cannot weigh them either. So I think it requires a bit of thinking as to how to organize that, and
yeah.
I'm not sure this is the forum for it, or whether IFAS might offer a jumping board or ASAP or whatever, but it requires a bit of careful planning, I think.
Yeah.
These things don't organize themselves, is my experience.
Yes. We've also had some experience. Anybody else? So what next? Okay, we have tentatively scheduled, I think, as the end.